Well, why do you want to change? See, I realize that the reason I want to have a different kind of motive is that I've got the same motive. So I say, oh, heaven's sakes, God, I'm a mess. And will you help me out? And then he reminds you, why are you doing that? Now you're just giving up, aren't you? You're asking someone else to take over your problem. So you suddenly find, you see, you're stuck. So in this way, what is called the Zen problem, or koan, is likened to a person who swallowed a ball of red-hot iron. He can't gulp it down and he can't spit it out. Or it's like a mosquito biting an iron bull. It's the nature of a mosquito to bite, and it's the nature of an iron bull to be unbiteable. And both go on doing their thing that is their nature. And so nothing can happen. And you realize, absolutely you're up against it. Absolutely no answer to this problem. No way out. Now what does that mean? If I can't do the right thing by doing, and if I can't do the right thing by not doing, what does it mean? It means, of course, that I, who essayed to do all this, am a hallucination. There is no independent self to be produced. There is no way at all of showing it, because it isn't there. So you recover from the illusion, and you suddenly wake up and think, oh, what a relief. And they call that satori. That's awakening, the first step in awakening. Let me try and translate this. When this kind of experience happens, you discover that what you are is no longer this sort of isolated center of action and experience locked up in your skin. The teacher has asked you to produce that thing, to show it to him genuine and naked, and you couldn't find it. So it isn't there. And when you see clearly that it isn't there, you have a new sense of identity. And you realize that what you are is, as I said, the whole world of nature doing this. Now that's a difficult thing for many Western people, because it suggests to them a kind of fatalism. It suggests that the individual is nothing more than the puppet of cosmic forces. So in the same way, when your own inner sense of identity changes from being the separate individual to being what the entire cosmos is doing at this place, you become not a puppet, but more truly and more expressively an individual than ever. This is the same paradox which the Christian knows in the form, whosoever would save his soul shall lose it. Now, I think that this is something of very great importance to the Western world today, because we have developed an immensely powerful technology. We have stronger means of changing the physical universe than has ever existed before. How are we going to use it? There is a Chinese proverb that if the wrong man uses the right means work in the wrong way. Let us assume that our technological knowledge is the right means. What kind of people are going to use this knowledge? Are they going to be people who hate nature and feel alienated from it? Or people who love the physical world and feel that the physical world is their own personal body? An extension, the whole physical universe, right out to the galaxies, is simply one's extended body. Now, at the moment, the general attitude of our technologists who are exploring space is represented in the term the conquest of space. And they are building enormous shell-like phallic objects to go bam into the sky. And this is downright ridiculous, because who is going to get anywhere in a rocket? You know, it takes a terrible long time even to get to the moon, and it's going to take longer than anybody can live to get outside the solar system, just to begin with. The proper way to study space is not with rockets, but with radio astronomy. Instead of going bang, you know, with a tough fist at the sky, become more sensitive. Develop subtler senses. That's radio astronomy. And everything will come to you. Be more open. Be more receptive. And eventually you will develop an instrument that will examine a piece of rock on Mars with greater care than you could if you were holding it in your own hand. Let it come to you. But you see, this whole attitude of using technology as a method of fighting the world will succeed only in destroying the world, as we are doing with absurd and uninformed and short-sighted methods of getting rid of insect pests, of forcing our fruit and tomatoes to grow, of stripping our hills of trees, and so on and so on, thinking that all this is some kind of progress when actually it is turning everything into a junk heap. It is said, you know, that Americans who are in the forefront of technological progress are materialists. Nothing is further from the truth. American culture is dedicated to the hatred of material and to its transformation into junk. Look at Los Angeles. Does it look as if it was made by people who loved material? It's all made out of ticky-tacky, which is a combination of plaster of Paris, papier-mâché, and plastic glue, and comes in any flavor. The important lesson, in other words, is technology and its powers must be handled by true materialists. And true materialists are people who love material, who cherish wood and stone and wheat and eggs and animals and, above all, the earth, and treat it with the reverence that is due to one's own body.
Your It continues with Session 5, The Art of Controlled Accident, Part 1.
Yesterday I was giving you a general outline of the foundations of the Zen feeling for naturalness in art and life by describing the fundamental principles of the Taoist philosophy and then of the Zen discipline itself. And we saw that the roots of the idea of spontaneous living make this conception, or rather it isn't so much a conception as a doing, something much more subtle than might ordinarily be imagined. A lot of people think that the spontaneous or completely natural life, as it's understood by these Far Eastern philosophers, is to act according to whim.
There was, for example, a great Zen monk lived shortly after 1000 AD, who had a very peculiar way of painting. He had long hair, and he'd get very drunk on rice wine. Then he'd soak his hair in ink and slosh it all over the paper. Then he would do a Rorschach test on it and decide what kind of a landscape it actually was, and then put in the finishing touches. And suddenly, out of this apparent mess, a great landscape would be evoked. But the whole art of the thing lay in putting in the finishing touches. And also, there's a very curious thing. If a person who is untrained in painting makes a mess with a brush, it's liable to be just a mess. Whereas if a person who has the feeling of painting in them for a long time, and they make a mess with a brush or just do anything, it looks interesting. And that's why if you try to copy the best people in modern, abstract, non-objective painting, you'll find it's a very difficult thing to do. Because there is more to spontaneity than caprice and disorder. And I want to try and explain what that is. I mean, wouldn't it be great if we could live absolutely on the spur of the moment? Not make any particular plans, not feel that... Well, you might make plans, because you can make plans spontaneously. But not to worry about whether you had made the right decision, whether you were being good or bad, selfish or unselfish, and not to hesitate in anything, you see? In one of the great applications of Zen, it was to the art of fencing. And when you learn fencing, you see you have to learn to be spontaneous, because here of all places it is true that he who hesitates is lost. If you're engaged in combat, you see, and you stop to think what sort of a defense or attack you ought to make, the enemy's got you. So the way they teach people spontaneity in fencing is very interesting. When you start in to fencing school, you of course live with the teacher. He has a kind of ashram. But you're given a janitorial job. You clean up, you wash dishes, you put bedding away and things like that. But while you're going about your daily business, the master surprises you with a practice sword which is made of four strips of bamboo, rather loosely tied together. And he hits you with this, surprisingly and suddenly, from nowhere. And you are expected to defend yourself with anything available, with the bedding, with the broom, with the pots and pans, just anything, defend. But the poor student never knows when the attack is coming, or what direction it's coming from, and he begins to get tense. And he begins to go around everywhere on the sort of alert, you see, watching which direction it's coming from. And as he goes down a certain passage, feeling that the master is probably lurking around that corner, and he's all set to go for him with that he gets that practice sword, he suddenly gets hit from behind. So eventually, he gives up. There's absolutely no way of preparing for the attack. And so he just wanders around feeling, well, if it hits, it's going to hit. And then he's ready to begin fencing. Because if you prepare for an attack from a specific direction and it comes from some other direction, you have to withdraw from the direction in which you had expected it and send your energy in another direction, and that takes time. So what you do is, you go around with a mind of no expectation. That is called mushin, or munen. This is a very important Zen expression. It almost means an empty mind. You could also call it no heart, because the character shin means both heart and mind, but it isn't quite the same as our word heartless, as we use it, and it isn't the same as the word mindless, as we use it, meaning stupid. To be in the state of mushin is to have a mind like a mirror and of This, the Taoist sage Zhuangzi said, the perfect man employs his mind as a mirror. It grasps nothing, it refuses nothing, it receives but does not keep. And when anything comes in front of a mirror, it reflects it instantly. The mirror doesn't wait to reflect it. They also say, when the moon rises, all bodies of water instantly reflect the moon. I mean, they don't bother with physics about the speed of light or anything like that. That's irrelevant. Or they say, when you clap your hands, the sound issues immediately. It doesn't stop to consider whether it will issue. And so sparks from the flint, when it's struck, they issue instantly. But to do this, you can't try to be quick. See, if a Zen master corners you with a funny situation, and he puts you in a quandary, expecting spontaneous action from you, don't try to hurry. I've watched Suzuki wait a whole minute before answering, but he doesn't hesitate. He's not at all embarrassed by this wait. And he can answer with silence just as well as with a formal response. The point is, do something. When two young Americans wanted to study Zen, they were taken by a Japanese monk to interview the master and act as interpreter. And one of them had had some practice, you know, he knew a bit about it. And so after they'd had tea together and just discussed formalities, the master said in a very easy way, well, what do you gentlemen know about Zen? And one of these students threw his fan, which he hadn't unfolded, the fan was still folded up, he threw it straight at the master's face. The master slightly moved to one side, and the fan went and went right through the paper wall. And the master laughed like a child. You know? That's the sort of game they get in. Once a master was going around through the forest with a group of students, and he picked up a tree branch. You know, just as one might pick up a tree branch, and suddenly he turned to one of his students and said, what is it? And he hesitated, so he hit him with the branch. And so another student was there, and he turned to him quickly. He said, what is it? He said, give it to me, I want to see it. I'll tell you. So the master tossed the branch to him, and he took it and hit the master. Now, you may think all this is kind of rough stuff, but let me give you another story, which is on a rather different level. A certain Zen priest was having dinner at a big party, and the party was being served by a geisha girl who was so elegant and so skillful in serving that he suspected she might have had some Zen training. And so he decided to try her out. And he nodded to her, and she immediately came to his place and sat down in front of his little low table. See, everybody would be seated, probably, in front of low tables all around a room, and the geisha servants and people move up and down in the middle. And so she came down and sat down in front of him and bowed, and he said, I would like to give you a present. And she said, I would be most honored. Now, on the table, there are hibachi, which are little braziers with hot charcoal in, and you move the charcoal around with iron chopsticks. He took a piece of charcoal out in iron chopsticks and offered it to her. She had long, long sleeves on her kimono, and what she did was this. She wound them all around her hands and took the charcoal. Immediately got up and went to the kitchen, disposed of the charcoal, changed her robe, which had holes burned all the way through the sleeves, and came back. And she sat down in front of the master and bowed. And she said to him, I would like to give you a present. He said, I would be most honored. And so she picked up the iron chopsticks and handed him the charcoal. And he pulled out a cigarette and said, that's just what I wanted, and lit the cigarette. Now, here's the lesson. The master's spontaneity and being ready for that situation was the kind of quick thinking that a good comedian has, who, in a completely unprepared way, can make all sorts of jokes and turn any situation into a jest of some kind. There are all sorts of people who do that. People who are experts in kind of like Dorothy Parker in that sort of repartee. But here it's